Hi, I'm Max Bergman.
And I'm Donatien Ruiz.
And this is The Europhile, a podcast where we look at Europe through a Washington lens.
Welcome to another episode of The Europhile. Today, we'll discuss the growing tensions between France and Germany following a recent meeting in Paris on the future of European defense and on Ukraine. After that, we'll discuss the EU's new defense industrial strategy before moving to Max's conversation with Charles Freese, the Deputy Secretary General for Peace, Security and Defense at the European External Action Service, on the EU's role as a defense actor. We hope you enjoy the show. All right, Max, let's get into it. So at the end of February, there is a summit in Paris to talk about Ukraine, support to Ukraine, and broadly the future of European defense. A few things were kind of in the background. The fact that this promise of ammunition to be delivered to Ukraine has not been entirely fulfilled. There's some good news coming out of it too. France has lifted its quasi-veto on spending money for non-EU ammunition to help Ukraine. And they also outlined five action categories on things like cyber defense, weapons co-production with Ukraine, mine clearing, and defense of other frontline countries like Moldova. So some good news coming out of it. However, a lot of the press since then has been focused on comments that were made after the summit, both by Macron, obviously the French president, and Chancellor Olaf Scholz. What is happening again in the Franco-German relationship?
Yeah, the last Europhile we recorded was before Macron had his press conference, before the results of that summit came to be known, which were frankly much more meager than I think many folks had expected. You know, part of the whole rationale that Macron brought all these people together was that the Munich Security Conference was this really depressing event where everyone was sort of nervous about Trump coming back and the future of Ukraine. This was supposed to be this sort of rallying moment. And it didn't really result in that. Instead, it has resulted in the past 2 weeks of essentially just another further decline in the Franco-German relationship. I think this is a case of where all the critiques of Macron are right, and all of what Macron is saying is also right, right? So I think what happened is that Macron's conference wasn't going to result in much, and he saw an opportunity to both curry favor with Eastern Europe, to highlight the strength of France, of being strategically minded, and therefore went out and said that all options were effectively on the table and that we may need to put boots on the ground to defend Ukraine. And that was a place where he hadn't gone before. I sort of think it's kind of a nothing statement. It's a bit like when U.S. officials and presidents were asked about what we would do if Iran did X, Y, and Z, and we would just say all options are on the table with sort of like an important finger wag. So it's sort of saying something without saying anything, a strategic ambiguity, as he put it. It turns out that there is more to it than I think many initially thought. The French had been thinking about this for a while. But what happened is Scholz then responds incredibly vigorously and says, absolutely not. He gives an address to the nation where he speaks to the country and says, like, we're not going to do this. And he gives all these sort of statements reacting to Macron. In some ways, he uses it to kind of, I think, for internal domestic political purposes. But then he steps in it when it comes to the tourist issue by then kind of revealing that the French and the UK actually may have some people on the ground advising the Ukrainians. And that leads to a really strong reaction from the Brits, especially, but including the French, being like, what the hell are you doing? And so it then sort of all blows up in Scholz's face. And then the whole tourist decision about whether to provide this long-range missile has become the major focal point of everybody. And Germany now looks like it's going through its continuous, efforts of saying no to a weapon system, then sort of gradually getting there. Now, I think the current idea is Germany will give its Taurus missiles to the UK so the UK can give its more long-range missiles. It's all really sort of maddening. And then when it comes to France, the whole issue of whether France would support third-party purchases of weapons both strikes me as, you know, what are you doing, France? Of course, like, just buy the ammunition. On the other hand, Europe needs to really ramp up its production. On the other hand, where is Europe actually going to buy this ammo from third-party countries? Like, I don't know, the Czechs may have a dealer that can hook them up, but like, the U.S. has gone around and bought a lot of this 155. So what this all, to just sum up, it's chaos, right? And what I think the broader problem here is, particularly I think from Berlin, is that they don't want to face the fact that Europe, that funding wars is incredibly expensive. And what Berlin is telling all the other European countries to do is basically saying that, well, we don't want to contribute, we Berlin, to more EU defense spending because we have this crazy constitutional court that is now blocking us. So everyone just contribute more bilaterally. But France does not have the fiscal capacity that Germany does. And also, France cares about its military, so it's not going to go below certain readiness levels. Because France is, frankly, prepared to fight tonight if it needs to be.
So we have also deployed in other places.
Deploys in other places, and the French are ready to go. So the German military is not ready to go anywhere right now. So Germany's saying spend more on a national level. But then you just did a new stability and growth pact at an EU level. There's concern about budget deficits again at the EU level. So there's not a lot of national capacity to spend more. And yet Berlin is both opposed to contributing more on a national basis to EU funding efforts. This is the European Peace Facility, and is opposing euro bonds for defense, which are, you know, being pushed by the Estonians and was an idea generated out of CSIS and other places, pushing for the EU to borrow for more defense. Have been very strongly supportive of that idea. So if what is the German plan for Europe here? There is no plan for Europe. And I think this leads to a lot of frustration in France. And this prompts then Macron to just sort of go very unilateral. And I'm currently in Madrid. And, you know, I've heard that, like, there's a lot of blame towards Berlin, but then the French will just sort of go in a very unilateral direction. And the lack of Franco-German cooperation essentially means that Europe is stuck. And this is the big question, is can France or Poland and other European states maybe work to push Europe in a certain direction? Anyway, it's sort of a rant, but it is not, I've gone on too long, but what we're seeing is a degree of chaos at the European level when it comes to defense, which doesn't bode well for Europe should they have an anti-Atlanticist president come to office in November.
Hypothetically. But to me, it's also, it feels like it's always such a reflexive attitude from Scholz. There's the way he reacted, he could have made statements that were more measured to say we are concerned about the idea of troops on the ground, they would not be doing XYZ. But instead, he just goes all out and it looks worse if down the line he backtracks. And it feels like he's very just afraid of his own shadow on a lot of these things. I know German public opinion is something that he's thinking about when it comes to procuring more weapons, to engaging more actively. But he continues to seem to ignore the fact that Germany is a huge actor in this entire dynamic, and that it's not just a national problem. It's a European problem, and he's putting his foot in it. In addition to the fact that domestically, he's dealing with a huge problem, the scandal of the leaked conversation of some of the generals in the Bundeswehr talking about Taurus and Ukraine. This is it's a huge embarrassment for the national security system in Germany that this conversation was leaked. It's 40 minutes of audio between really high level government officials, security, defense officials talking about this Taurus problem. So he's just caught between all of this. And it feels like instead of actually trying to take it head on, it's kind of a turtle effect, and he just says no to everything. And so, yes, you can have concerns about Macron's antics because he does like to throw out really controversial statements, the NATO brain dead, etc. But at the end of the day, if that makes the things move a little bit more, that's good. To me, it's also, I'm curious about, because we've talked about some realignments recently, France being more friendly again to some Eastern European nations. Friendly might not be the best term, but just more open to engage on their ideas for European defense, especially when it comes to Russia. I'm curious if that's going to push this dynamic forward even more, because there's a lot more alignment with France on the Eastern side the Czech Republic has pushed really hard for this ammo deal. Petr Fiala, the prime minister, was just saying, yes, we would like EU ammo, but we need something to hold us over in between. So I'd be curious to see that as well and see how it evolves in the next few months.
Yeah, one thing I didn't say about this whole affair is I think actually Scholz is right. Right? Like the notion of putting French troops on the ground. I mean, there's a difference between kind of covertly supporting the Ukrainians, deploy missiles that you're providing, and actually putting real boots on the ground. I think Scholz is right here. And I think many in Washington would not be supportive of a really robust French military presence in Ukraine, even if it's not on the front lines, but further back in Kyiv. I don't quite know what they're thinking, what they're...
Well, I also don't know how you do non-military tasks. Yeah, in an active conflict situation.
It's all a little, I think, it's once you sort of dip your toe in a place, as the United States has found, you find yourself neck deep very quickly. So I think Scholz is actually right about that. But then what is the plan from Berlin?
And it also seems like the coalition, once again, the different partners have different views. In the UK-German meeting that we saw the foreign ministers, Baerbock almost sounded like she was trying to covertly make the point that they would be open to more aggressive stance, including on Taurus, for example. But she can't say it out loud.
Yeah.
Whereas Scholz is still very much holding back.
It just hits on the long-running theme of this is sort of an incoherent coalition that has never really felt like it got off the ground running. And we're... And I think the criticism I have of the Scholz government is that I don't see what the strategy is for Europe. Like, I don't see any vision out of Berlin for Europe. And that way, it's very similar to the Merkel governments of the past. And I think there was a lot of hope in Paris and other places, here in Madrid, for instance, that there would be a clear vision. And instead, what I think is annoying to pro-European groups all over the continent is that instead they're stuck with Macron being the pro-European voice. And that, you know, I think Macron says some good stuff, but then his style and it really rubs many folks the wrong way. But maybe, you know, we'll turn to the EU announced something I think has quite big potential ramifications for Washington, a new EU defense strategy. The conversation I have with Charles Fries was discussed just a day before it became official, but we kind of had a beat on what's in it. I actually went to the European Commission in January with a bunch of think tankers to talk about ideas that could go in it. And I think it's a really important strategy. Now, it really pushes the boundaries of where the EU has been before. And I think for it to be successful, the key question will be whether it will be able to come with money. And what the strategy basically outlines is the need for the Europeans to start buying more European. Now, that won't be good news to many American defense companies and will lead to, I think, heart palpitations. But the fact is, right now, U.S. defense industry has trouble meeting U.S. demand. And I think it sort of dawned on the Europeans that if there was like a conflict in the Indo-Pacific, and you're reliant on many U.S. defense suppliers for munitions and other things like that, well, that's all going to go to the U.S. military first. And the lack of a European defense industrial base is a huge problem. And NATO doesn't really play that role. NATO sets targets for European countries of capabilities that it wants European countries to have, but it doesn't tell them where and how to buy it and doesn't coordinate those purchases. So part of what this effort is about is trying to incentivize European countries and companies to begin to work together on their joint procurements so that we don't have kind of absurd situations of like, I think I've said it on the show before, the Czech Republic and Slovakia needing to replace the same system because they used to be the same country and buying the same system, but then making it different and then making it not interoperable. So that, I think, is the rationale behind the strategy. It makes sense, but then this is all a national competency. So the question is whether member states will balk and then whether there'll be any funding at the end of the day.
Well, the balking at it, to me, it depends who gets what out of it, right? That's kind of always the problem here. But that's also how you build coalitions, is to make sure that whatever investments come out of this are spread out enough between different member states that already have a good enough defense industrial base, and the ones who don't, finding ways to bring them into that fold without, once again, just duplicating a bunch of efforts. And then, of course, what kind of money is put behind this? Because the targets are really ambitious. We're talking about by 2030, procuring at least 40% of equipment in collaborative manner, intra-EU defense trade, like 35% of the value. It's just, it's great. Ambition is great. But is there money behind this? Because as we all know, the current MFF, the Multiannual Financial Framework, or the EU budget basically goes until 2027. That's 3 years from now. I don't know how much money is left to scrape around, given what they've had to do already for the peace facility, for COVID recovery, et cetera, to, for this first phase, which really should hit with a bang. There's not a lot of money to come around. The outline right now says 1.5 billion euros to start, but there needs to be a big announcement to put a lot of money behind it. Thierry Breton has said 100 billion is necessary, but is there going to be the political will to put that money there when we look at all the different European countries that already don't want to do joint debt, for example, for national, historically national priorities in Europe, like safety nets, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big question. The other thing that it points to is that basically that if the EU could get funding, then it would start buying weapons. It could use that to help create stockpiles of systems that then could be used to enhance Europe's ability to sell abroad. So, you know, the commission with a very kind of commercial focus sort of tries to emulate some aspects of the foreign military sales system that we have in the US, and not to get too in the weeds, but that's basically most of the time when countries buy from US companies, they're actually buying from the US government. And then the US government is the one that actually has the program of record with defense companies. And so that's good for the United States when we do sales abroad, because what it means is we're lowering our per unit costs. So if we're buying, you know, X number of Patriot missiles from Raytheon and Lockheed Martin, well, if you get foreign orders from the US government, then US government puts in a bigger order. And then it allows us to kind of rack and stack, decide where these systems will go. The broader point I want to point to is, if this strategy is realized, let's just say tomorrow, you know, 100 billion euros or 250 billion euros are borrowed for defense and for Ukraine, what it would mean is that the EU would then start to need to have its own policy when it comes to arms sales abroad, which are currently done at the national level and not really coordinated. So that would have, I think, real foreign policy implications, I think in a good way, because frankly, there aren't a lot of, you know, we think of the Europeans have a very high standards when it comes to arms sales. That is not the case at all. The French will sell to anybody. Most European countries will sell to anybody. And actually, when it comes to the US, we're very careful, especially on the technology side. It may not seem that way, but there's a lot of really advanced systems that we hold back from very close partners because we're, you know, not quite sure we want them to have the best of the best. And Europe doesn't quite have those processes in place. So a lot of potential implications of this defense in industrial strategy.
A lot of implications. And I'd be so curious to see just the negotiations for conditions on the arms sales, because Germany has been a lot more cautious. As you said, France is more open to selling arms to other partners and non-partner countries. But you, with other colleagues on the team, wrote a great critical questions, or basically a piece about this strategy. And I would recommend all our listeners read it, because it goes through the details, the weeds of the strategy, but also some big questions that remain. One that I want to talk about is the fact that the UK is nowhere to be seen here, because it's been a while since I've mentioned our friends on the island.
Who?
And yeah, exactly. That's the feeling when you read this is, wait, who? Where are they? So there was this meeting of, you know, Germany and the UK, but what does that mean? That they're not mentioned here? Did you hear about conversations in the background on we'll try to include them down the line, or this is just not on the radar at all and we're going to have to backtrack into it?
So I think it's a really good flag that the UK is not in this, but I think we can also read a little too much into it, right? The UK is about to have elections. And if there was a whole strategy written by the EU about how the UK is going to be intimately involved in this EU strategy, there's some backlash politics that could occur. And I think the EU just doesn't want to play a role in that. Now, what is pretty clear is the Labour Party, which, you know, if you look at the polling and literally all the polling, it shows a huge Labour victory. Looks almost inevitable at this point, whether the elections are held in May or the fall or in January at the last possible date. It looks like Labour is on track to win. And there's defense is an area where the Labour Party has already indicated a real desire to engage the EU. We've seen that in the past. I mean, the Saint Malo declaration that was done in 1998 between Jacques Chirac and Tony Blair was an example of France and the UK, you know, we're going to join together for a big EU defense initiative. So this is something that was sort of been part of Labour in the past of working with the EU on defense. But more specifically, when it comes to the defense industrial side, the UK is part of the EU defense industrial base, like as a factual matter, right? When you look at the missiles that are being sent to Ukraine, the Scalp missiles, well, they're UK French. There's all these joint collaborations between UK and other European defense companies. And this strikes me as something that the UK will have to be a part of and will want to be part of, because it will be in their interest to be part of it. It will be in the interest of UK defense companies. And when we think about the EU defense industrial base, that also includes Norway. While Norway is not part of the EU, it pays into the EU budget, and all these things apply to Norway, right? And so I think the EU moving in a strong defense direction, I think, is actually a way of bringing the UK back kind of somewhat into the EU fold, at least when it comes to the defense and security conversation.
That's a really good point about Norway and a good model for collaboration. But maybe we can leave it here, because that's a great segue into the conversation you had with Charles Friis. And we'll turn now to that interview.
Maybe I could start by asking you about Ukraine. And as someone that has been a longstanding diplomat, both in France and now at the EU level, are you surprised by the EU's response to the war in Ukraine? If you had sort of gone back 2 years ago and someone would have said the EU has trained 60,000 forces, the EU has provided all this funding and financing for Ukraine security assistance, would you have believed it? Are you surprised at where the EU has ended up? Or do you think there's a lot more to be done, and are you in some ways wish that more had happened?
Thank you, Max, for this question, because I think you're right. 2 years ago, when we decided to take very quickly all these actions, I think that was a big surprise and a good surprise, and a very bad surprise, by the way, for Putin. Because Putin had not anticipated that the EU will be so united, so efficient in immediately after the start of the invasion. You know, that was a Thursday, 24th of February. Mm-hmm. And 4 days after, we had already adopted our first sanctions packages. We decided to suspend the broadcasting of Sputnik and Russia Today. And during this famous first weekend, I was with my team responsible for the presentation of our first package for military support to Ukraine. And as I said in my preliminary remarks, we had this instrument, the European Peace Facility, which had never been used in mm-hmm. the past. That was a new instrument, but it has never been used in the past to finance the acquisition of weapons or to reimburse member states for the weapons they are going to give to Ukraine. And we said we are going to put on the table an envelope of 500 million euros. And it was decided in 2 hours. Mm-hmm. So I think what happened with Ukraine, with this very strong and firm reaction by the EU, I think it was indeed a very positive surprise. And I think it's a new illustration that Europe makes progress only in very difficult circumstances. When Europe has a knife at the throat. Mm-hmm. When you have the knife at the throat and you need to take bold decisions, the EU is taking the right decisions. Two other examples. For the COVID pandemic in 2020, that was, of course, a terrible crisis, for the first time, that was a subject discussed many years before, but for the first time, because of the extraordinary circumstances, the EU decided to have a common debt, to mutualize a huge loan. Mm-hmm. Another example, in 2008, when there was a financial crisis, here again, the EU member state decided to work how we can create a banking union. So I think what happened with Ukraine, it's a new illustration that when there is a crisis, very strong one, either the EU is totally weak and passive, or we decide things which were not thinkable before. Mm-hmm. And another example, if I may, I mentioned the delivery of weapons. I mentioned the EU military training mission, which is indeed the largest military training mission that we have ever launched. But for the first time, and I can tell you it was totally unimaginable before the war, we decided to use the EU budget to finance the industry which produces ammunition and missiles. It's what we call the ASAP mm-hmm. instrument. And another example, we also decided to use the EU budget to encourage member states to jointly procure. Here again, I think if we had asked the question to member states in 2021, that it would have been a no-go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to maybe ask what the Washington's reaction has been to the EU increasingly doing more in the security and defense space. We're approaching the NATO Washington summit here that will be here in July, in the midst of the heat of not only summer but of our political season. But it was 25 years ago at the previous Washington summit in 1999, where the Clinton administration has sort of articulated this concern that about the EU duplicating NATO, and that has sort of become essentially U.S. doctrine. And opposition to the EU doing defense has been, I think, ingrained not only in Republican administrations, but really in Democratic administrations as well. So I'm curious, in the response to the war, we're seeing the EU take all these actions. What has been Washington's response? What has been this administration's response to the EU proposing and suggesting to buy ammunition or to train forces or to provide funding or to develop a defense industrial strategy for that matter?
I think the perception in Washington about the EU has changed, and has changed for the better. I can compare when I was in NATO in 2020 or in 2021, when we spoke about what we wanted to do as EU in the area of security and defense, sometimes there were some suspicions about what we wanted to do. And after all the concrete actions I've just mentioned, I think NATO and also particularly the United States have seen that with our means, with our instruments, we can bring an added value in full complementarity with what NATO is doing. So indeed, we don't want to duplicate NATO. NATO is a cornerstone of the Euro-Atlantic security. NATO is in charge of collective defense, and NATO has done a tremendous job after the 24th of February in order to strengthen the deterrence and the collective defense on the eastern flank. But we, as EU, we can propose, we can adopt measures which complement what NATO is doing and what NATO cannot do mm-hmm. to finance the delivery of weapons, to train soldiers, and I told you that we are going to train 60,000 soldiers by next summer. We adopt sanctions. So I think it's an excellent example of what, yes, the added value and the good complementarity. So what we are doing as EU, I think it's a very good contribution for strengthening the transatlantic relationship, and we try to do our share and to complement what NATO is doing.
And you mentioned at the start of your remarks all the places where the EU is conducting military missions, including in the Red Sea. And there has been this concern of where the duplication concern, a part of NATO and the United States, when the EU acts, it will take forces away that could be
available to NATO missions. Do you think that's a concern of when the EU starts maybe doing more in the world, that it could detract from NATO's ability to call on those same forces? And how are you working through those issues currently with NATO?
No, I think there is really no risk because what we try to do is to have the possibility to react in case of a crisis, in case of certain situations where NATO and the United States don't want to intervene. When I spoke in my intervention about strategic responsibility, it's exactly this. We are living in a more and more dangerous and unpredictable environment. We mentioned the war, the return of the war in Europe. We have the Middle East events. We have the tension in the South Caucasus. We have the deterioration of the security in the Sahel. We have a lot of theaters, more and more dangerous, and which can affect directly European security interests. So we need to be able to project ourselves, to defend our own security interests with our partners each time it's possible, so with the United States, with NATO, etc. But there can be, it could be that in some situations NATO say, it's not for us, it's for you. It's for you Europeans. If you want to do something, do it. And for being able to do it, we need capabilities. And so that's why when we try, for instance, to establish this EU rapid deployment capacity, which will be created next year in 2025, capacity up to 5,000 soldiers, it's precisely to be able, it's not a huge quantity in comparison with the NATO figures, but it is a good instrument in case we need, for instance, to evacuate European citizens in a third country because there is a big crisis, or if a government which asks us for help because he fears to be destabilized. So we need to have our own capacities in order to react, particularly in situations where NATO or the United States don't want to do it. But what we are developing, our capabilities that we are producing, they can be also used for NATO. You know the famous principle of the single set of forces. So the member states, they are not schizophrenic. If they develop the production of a battle tank, of a plane, of a ship, it should be used. And all this is according to NATO military standards. And so all this is interoperable. And so member states have the capacity to use such equipments for EU operation if needed, but also they can use such capacities for NATO operation. So I think there is a freedom of action and also solidarity among allies on this issue.
Right, so you're pointing out that essentially because the EU is organizing itself or providing funding, that it's going to be additive to NATO capabilities. Let me ask you about the defense industrial strategy that the EU is going to unveil tomorrow. As you said, we were hoping it was going to be today. But I want to maybe ask from a sort of a Washington perspective or a U.S. perspective here. I could see a lot of American defense companies looking at this proposal and in some of your comments about how Europe needs to spend its euros on European production and say, well, wait a second. We like the current setup where the United States sells a lot of equipment to European countries, and perhaps everyone's buying different equipment in Europe, but maybe if everyone just bought American, we would be better off. Is this potentially creating a more difficult environment for U.S. defense companies? Is this a form of EU protectionism? That phrase has been thrown around over the years and decades. Is this about protecting the European defense industry and pushing American sales to the side?
Not at all. Not at all. I think we should start from the beginning. The beginning of this strategy is the return of the war in Europe. The return of the war in Europe with the fact that Europe is more and more in danger. That was what Mr. Borrell said even he said that in 2021, even before the start of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So we have a deterioration of our security situation of our security environment. So we see that with what's happening in Ukraine, it's not only a battle on the ground. It's now more and more a war of production. It's a war of attrition, but also it's a war of industrial production. We know that Russia has increased its level of production of weapons in Russia, and I don't mention the imports coming from Iran or North Korea. And so, if we want to be more supportive of Ukraine, we need to produce more in order to continue supporting Ukraine, and also to replenish our own stocks. And so the idea is that as we are in a war of production, the European defense industry needs to adapt to this new reality. And so that's why we want to produce more, faster, together and European, because we want to be war capable. What we saw at the beginning of the war is that we were not war capable. A lot of military high-rank officials, or even some ministers, said that, you know, if there was the war in Europe, not between Russia and Ukraine, our stocks of ammunition, for instance, would allow us to resist only a few weeks. So we need to produce more. And so the strategy that we are going to adopt tomorrow, it's not to close our market for the U.S. companies, not at all, because we will continue as it is already existing, but we will. The objective is to strengthen our industrial base. We need, you know, if we want to have what we call European sovereignty, if we want to develop our strategic responsibility, we can not speak about such nice words if, in practice, we don't have a strong European defense industry. So indeed, you said that. Perhaps there could be some concerns in the U.S. on this issue, but that's what I say in my preliminary remarks, that there should be no misperceptions, because the U.S. Can already participate in many EU defense initiatives. I mentioned that there are several, for instance, in 2021-2022, 15 U.S. subsidiaries were eligible to EU funding with the European Defence Fund. Second example, you know, I mentioned the European Peace Facility, which reimburses member states who give military equipment to Ukraine. I can tell you that there were US equipment which were given by member states to Ukraine, and it's not because these equipments were American that the EPF money could not be given to member states. The third illustration is that when we have tried to calculate what happened in terms of acquisitions from February 2022, so the beginning of the war in Ukraine, and June 2023, 78% of the acquisitions made by the EU member states were made abroad, mm-hmm. and including 63% to the US. So I think the fact to say that the EU is protectionist, that EU is closing its market, it's really fake news. Mm-hmm. Fake news. We are open. Our EU defense initiatives are open. Of course, there are some criteria. The company, or the subsidiary, has to be established in the EU. The executive management structure has to be located in the EU, and there are some security conditions which have to be respected. It's normal. You do the same in the US. That means, you know, in terms of intellectual property, or the fact that we don't want any kind of restrictions for the use of the product which would be developed in the EU. But if all these conditions are respected, our EU defense initiatives are open. And that will be the case also for the future strategy adopted tomorrow, and with a future program that will be presented. So once again, if the criteria are met, U.S. subsidiaries can take part. And I hope there will be no misunderstanding mm-hmm. on this, because I think it's very important to understand that if I may, I hope I will not be misinterpreted, I think it is in the interest of the US to have a strong European partner, and because that will be precisely a better burden sharing. And so on one side, the US cannot always ask us to spend more in our defense, and on the other side, to criticize us because we are not trying to boost, to boost our defense industry. Yeah? I think there is a need for a certain consistency. So we need to boost our defense industry. That's what we are going to do with the communication adopted tomorrow, to encourage joint procurement from the European defense industry, to encourage to give more financial support to companies which produce weapons, not only ammunition and missiles, but to try to extend the scope. For instance, for drones, we could imagine that in the future the EU budget money could be used for supporting the production of drones in Europe. But I think at the end, you know, the risk for NATO and the risk for the US would be a too modest European defense industry. Mm-hmm. If we don't have enough defense capabilities, I think it's more risky for the for a solid NATO than the opposite. So if we want a more balanced and a better burden sharing, I think really it's in interest of the US to understand and to support what we are doing. Once again, it will not be at the expense of the US defense industry. And I think I've given some examples mm-hmm. where the US defense industry is already very present in our different EU initiatives.
And in many respects, our defense industry right now is stressed as it is to meet the needs of the U.S. military, and that's a constant conversation in Washington. And so the potential for the U.S. defense industry to also have to meet the needs of allies and partners in the midst of a conflict, I think, is an general concern. So having more capacity, I think, is overall very positive. But let me ask you sort of how would this work in practice? Because national defense is a national responsibility still within Europe. So it's up to the national ministries of defense and national governments to decide what they're going to procure. A recent example I heard was that Slovakia and the Czech Republic, where you served as ambassador, you know, they used to be the same country. So they had the same Soviet infantry fighting vehicles, which they gave to Ukraine. And then when both went to buy new infantry fighting vehicles, well, they both went to Sweden to purchase a vehicle from Sweden, but they bought the same vehicle but with different guns, eliminating the interoperability. But how do you incentivize them to work together? I mean, it's hard for ministries of defense to work together. I can't imagine our Pentagon working with anyone else on procurement. And when they do, it's incredibly challenging. So how do you incentivize or mandate this sort of cooperation? And there's a lot of EU initiatives floating out there, but they don't seem to be well-funded enough to really push the cooperation that I think you're envisioning and that many in Europe are envisioning.
I think you used the right word. What the EU can do is to incentivize. We cannot force a member state to make an acquisition in Europe, in the States, in South Korea, or elsewhere. The defense policy is a competence of member states. It's not an EU competence. So what we can do is to encourage them to work together. And we tell them, if you work together, you will have a financial support. We don't oblige you to use a framework that we are creating for you, for instance, particularly for joint procurement. So if you are not interested, it's your choice. But we try to offer you, if I may say, a carrot, a financial carrot, and also sometimes other, sometimes also legal instruments, which can be interesting for member states. And we saw that this policy when we adopted last year, you know, the famous plan for ammunition for Ukraine. Mm-hmm. You remember that in March 2023, there was already at that time the priority to give more ammunition to Ukraine. And so we decided that we had to deliver 1 million ammunition in 1 year for Ukraine. And what we did is we created in 6 weeks, which was really a record time to have everybody on board, with 2.5 billion euros on the table. So it was a huge initiative. And we said to the member states, please, we think it's better for you to jointly procure for ammunition of 155 millimeter caliber. And if you do this, and if you produce jointly, and after that, if you give the ammunition to Ukraine, you will be partially reimbursed. So, you know, that's a sort of financial incentive. If you don't want to do it, if you want to buy this ammunition alone, you can do it. But we try to offer you an encouragement to work together. So it's always like this it works. You know, I think you're right to say that I think member states are very much attached to their own choices, to their own policy. But we think at the EU that if member states work together, we have economies of scale, we have better prices, we have more predictability for the industry, and also we have more interoperability, because the more you work together, the better at the end it's for everybody. I would like to remember you that the former defense minister, Mr. Reznikov, you know, he received so many different types of equipment mm-hmm. coming from all the partners that he said that his country had become a military zoo because he had so many different types of tanks, missiles, ammunition that he has for his country that was a logistic nightmare. So the more we work together, the more we reduce the fragmentation of the defense market, which is a huge problem for Europe. And I think the more efficient we are. I would like to remember you that in the States there is one type of battle tank, mm-hmm. when in Europe you have 17 mm-hmm. different types of battle tank. We cannot continue like this. The problem of Europe, and I think the problem of EU member states, is that when we want to buy defense equipment, member states do it too much alone and abroad. Mm-hmm. Alone, I give you the figure, in 2021, 82% of acquisitions made in the EU by member states were made under purely national logic. So 18% in a collaborative way. It's too 18%. It's too low, and so that's why we want to encourage such corporations, because I think it will have all the advantages I tried to describe.
I want to turn to some questions from the audience, and one is about the ASAP proposal or the ASAP initiative, because on the one hand, Thierry Breton, the European Commissioner, highlighted that the EU now has the capacity to hit to deliver 1 million shells, but it's not delivering yet 1 million shells. There's now a Czech proposal out there to go and buy from a third party, and there's dispute about how to use EU funding. Should EU funding be used to buy abroad to get ammunition to Ukraine, which just doesn't, you know, Ukraine doesn't care where the ammunition comes from. Has ASAP succeeded or failed in meeting its goals? Is it on track? Maybe you could assess where is it actually, and why hasn't it gotten to the 1 million mark? And what do you think of the Czech proposal out there to buy from third parties?
So perhaps on the ammunition initiative, because I mentioned the very ambitious plan which was adopted last year, but it's true that now we are in March, so 1 year later, and we have reached a little bit more than 50% of the objective. We will have reached the objective to donate 1 million shells to Ukraine by the end of the year, and even before the end of the year. At the end of the year, according to the estimates given by member states, we will have given to Ukraine 1,150,000 shells. So there is a slight delay indeed, which is of course not positive for Ukraine, it's obvious, but we have done our utmost. And when I said that the role of the EU is to organize a framework and to give incentives, after that the ball is in the court of member states. And something that High Representative Borrell has always emphasized is that this framework exists and is said to the member state, use it. For instance, the European Defense Agency has been used for this ammunition initiative, but only 7 member states have used the framework contracts which had been negotiated by the European Defense Industry and the European Defense Agency and the companies which are in Europe. And so the European Defense Agency has still a spare capacity to produce more ammunition of 155 for an amount equivalent of 1.5 billion euros. So the problem is not that I think we have the production capacity, and Commissioner Breton is right to say that now the production capacity of ammunition 155 is 1 million. At the end of the year, that will be 1.4 million per year, and next year, by the end of next year, that will be 2 million. But it's a production capacity. To produce, you need orders. Mm-hmm. And if member states don't pass the orders, we have the problem that we are facing now, because not enough orders have been made. And that's why now there is this Czech initiative that you've just mentioned, which is a good initiative, I think, because it's a very pragmatic one. I think this initiative takes place in the broader context I've just described to try to give as quickly as possible ammunition to Ukraine. And so the Czech initiative is to say, should we not try to find immediately available ammunition in non-EU countries? So I think the Czech president mentioned the figure of 800,000 shells, 155, 152. It's an ad hoc initiative. I hope it will work. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think it's complementary to what we try to do. What I can tell you is that High Representative Borrell sent a letter again 2 weeks ago, and he said to the member states, to all ministries of defense and foreign affairs, you have to make an extra effort to dig into your stocks. Second, you should pass more orders. Third, if you know that in certain countries you can buy immediately ammunition, buy them, and it's possible in such a case to be reimbursed by the EPF. So we don't have ideological preconceived ideas. What we want is to support Ukraine as efficiently as possible. And fourth, the fourth option is to finance Ukrainian defense industry, because I went, of course, many times to Ukraine, and during my last trip, the one of the messages of Ukraine is that they want to produce more ammunition in Ukraine. They have the capacity to produce. What they are lacking is money. Mm. So at the end of the day, we are always going to the same problem, financing. And here again, we need to be creative.
That's it for today's episode. As always, if you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. To learn more about the EU's new defense industrial strategy, you can check out a short piece on the strategy written by myself, as well as my good colleagues, Mathieu Durion, Otto Svensson, and Sissy Martinez. It's linked in the episode description. You may also be interested in our sister podcast, Russian Roulette, which you should really check out. It covers the latest on Vladimir Putin's Russia and the ongoing war in Ukraine. Our thanks, as always, to our producer, Sean Falk, and to Otto Svensson for coordinating and researching this episode. We'll be back soon with another assessment of Europe through a Washington lens. Until next time.